You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey, Chris Webster here, founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network, and as the APN takes a break this holiday season, we're using this opportunity to bring you episodes from shows you may not be aware of. This one is from Heritage Voices, hosted by Jessica Oquinto, and this is episode 98, where she brings on a few guests to discuss how climate change was causing artifacts to erode out of a shoreline, so a native village in Alaska requested an archaeological excavation so that their heritage would be documented. On to the show.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 98. I'm Jessica Oquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about the Nunatak Digital Museum. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nooch or Ute Peoples Treaty Lands, the Dene Taw, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Jacqueline Nalikutak, Cleveland, Charlotta Hillardahl, Lani Alaskuk, Strunk, and Alice Watterson on the show. And they are all going to introduce themselves. So Jackie, would you mind getting us started?
Hi, thank you. Paka nalikutarunga yuchten kuin hakmiungalasu. I just introduced myself as Nalikutak, which is my Yupik name, and I also said I'm from Quinhock. My English name is Jacqueline Cleveland, as you just heard, and I hold a bachelor's degree in media and theater arts with a minor in Native American studies from Montana State University. And today I consider myself a documentary filmmaker and photographer by trade and a subsistence gatherer and advocate by heart. I live with my husband and two dogs in our little house in Quinhock. Thank you.
Thank you. Charlotta?
My name is Charlotta Hillardahl, and I'm originally from Sweden, but I now live in Scotland, where I work at the University of Aberdeen as an archaeologist. I have been working with the Nunatak project since almost the beginning, for 15 years now. I think that's me.
And Lani?
I introduced myself in Yupik. My Yupik name is Alaskuk, but my English name is Lani Strunk. I'm from Quinhock, but now I live in Anchorage, and I got my master's degree at the University of Washington in computational linguistics, and right now I work on creating native language websites with another native guy. Yeah, thanks for having me here.
Yeah. All right. And last but not least, Alice.
Hi, I'm Alice Watterson. I'm an archaeologist and a reconstruction artist. I'm originally from Scotland. So when I started working on this project, I was at the University of Dundee, and I'm now based in Iceland at the University of Iceland. So on the Nunatak project, I've been working with the team since, I think, 2017, and I'm the artist and interaction designer for the Nunatak Digital Museum and for the early educational resource that we made as well. So that's me.
Yeah, welcome to the show, everybody. I'm so excited to have you here. And thank you to Cambridge University Press for reaching out and wanting to do this interview about this article that you all had in antiquity. And so before we get started, though, Would you mind giving us a little bit of background? Like, I mean, listening to all those intros, I'd be wondering, how did you guys all get connected? You're all over the world. So would someone mind giving a little context?
Yeah, so we're going to focus today on the Digital Museum, which is kind of the latest outreach or public product that we have from the Nunachlik project. But the Nunachlik project started about 15 years ago in 2009 as a very small excavation and has then grown over the years to a very large and kind of a large project with a lot of different areas of research. But in the center of this is the Nunachlik site, which is an archaeological site just on the coast by the Bering Sea, which is eroding very fast. And this is how the project started. So members in Quinnock saw that a lot of old objects were turning out on the beach. So the village board took the decision to try to excavate and find an archaeologist who would come and look at the site. So it's a project that's initiated by the Yupik community from the beginning to try to save their heritage, their archaeological heritage that was eroding. It is also one of the aims with the project and the reason that the village agreed to do this, which is not a obvious decision maybe for a Yupik community, is to reconnect the younger generations with the Yupik heritage and kind of build new bridges into traditional Yupik culture. So I'm an archaeologist, and I was on the project from the second year. The leader of the Nunachlik project is Dr. Rick Knecht, who is Alaskan, or he's worked in Alaska for so many years that he turned Alaskan. and he was just starting his job in the University of Aberdeen. So that's how it became a kind of part Scottish project as well. So we've had a big research team from Scotland, but then because this is how science works often, a lot of people connecting from different parts of the world. And we have had volunteers working on the project as well. But it is very important to emphasize that this is a community-based project and that the community has been like the central part of the project the whole time. And therefore, it was also very important for us to have something that can be accessible and reach out to people that is not an academic paper or similar.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, Lonnie and Jackie, one thing that comes to my mind first with that intro is like, could you give a little bit of background like on the community itself and where you guys are located also?
So in 2009, it was between my sophomore and junior year of high school, and so I was still in the village, and so I got to meet all of the archaeologists that would come out, and I would drive up the beach and go visit them and ask them exactly what are you guys finding today. And so they were always a part of the summer feeling of in Quinnock, and you would see them walking around and we just become comfortable with them being around us. And then after I went to university, I would come back during August, and that was the time when they would have their annual village showcasing of the artifacts, the mm-hmm. finds of the artifacts. And so there was always a general sense of community involvement in those, being a part of the community during the summer and then having this big showcase at the end of the summer. And so,
yeah, that's very cool. What were those showcases like?
They would have a bunch of tables set out in the gathering space, and archaeologists would be at different spots, and they would show all of the finds that they were cleaned up, not yet preserved yet. And they would invite all of the elders, and all the kids would come, and all the adults. And so you could interact with all of the archaeologists and the artifacts and ask them questions. And it was a really interesting time to see especially the elders and how they would start talking about their experiences with these artifacts, and it would bring up memories of their past. And so it was really interesting.
And we'd have a big potluck as well. That's always fun. a bit of a kind of end of dig celebration, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. First, so, and just to give a little bit of context, it looks like you guys are kind of like west, emphasis on the west over the south of Anchorage, like you said, on the Bering Sea. So how many people live in Quinhok?
So it's about 725 to 750 in that range. And Quinhok is also pronounced in Yupik, Quinhok, meaning the new river channel. And yeah, I'll just kind of go back on to the question of just a little bit more about the community. I mean, I think it's a very special place, just not just because I grew up here, but, you know, my family came from the village north of here, from Apogah. Well, it's actually a camp, moved here in the early 60s. So I myself have lived here my whole life, but I've always felt lucky because, I mean, we're sandwiched by two freshwater, you know, alpine lake fed rivers. We're right on the coast. We have a mountain range that's not so far. You know, we're just surrounded by so much life, and not just, you know, geographically, but by language and culture as well. You know, Quinhok is one of the villages, kind of last standing villages, who are still speaking Yupik as their first language and participating in the subsistence way of life. And, you know, each season is like a whole new world. So, you know, right now we're about to hit spring. And as you'll see in the digital museums, we did make sure to, you know, show every season, because this is what we base our life around, are these seasons and the resources we can live off of. And thank you for having me on the show. I forgot to say that earlier.
Of course. Yeah.
I'm excited. Oh, I think I forgot to say that too. Sorry. Thank you.
Forgot to say that too.
Well, it is mutual. I'm definitely very excited to have all of you on. Yeah, the article was super interesting to read, and I love the way that it is, you know, very easy to read, but contains a lot within it. There's pictures. It's very pretty. Anyone that's interested should check out the show notes, the link to both the museum and the article, because I think the article is honestly what a lot of things should be moving towards, from my personal opinion. Okay, before we get too far away, thank you for the context. And also, I'm thinking about this community showcase, which I really love. And I can just imagine like being part of those conversations, you know, with the elders that I work with, for example, that they get really excited when it's things like that, like, oh, my grandmother, you know, had something like this, blah, blah, blah. So what, you know, like these artifacts or belongings were put on display, and then what happened to them?
So the artifacts, they come from the site that has been dated between 1570 and 1675. So it's pre-contact, before European contact. And there's very few sites that have been excavated in Yupik country that belong to this. And then the Nachlik site turned out to be extremely rich site, in a lot of knowledge embedded there and a lot of very beautiful and spectacular artifacts. So when we first started excavation, these artifacts were sent temporary on loan to the University of Aberdeen to be preserved and recorded properly and done research on. And then in the beginning, we weren't sure where they would go. We knew they were going to go back to Alaska, but the plan was originally to maybe have a larger museum host them, maybe in Anchorage or in Bethel. But then the more time that went on, the more convinced everyone in the project was that this artifact really needed to go home, go back to Quinhok. So the village board and Warren Jones, who is the CEO of Carnictook Inc., the ANGSA corporation in Quinnahock, they took the decision in 2016 that the artifacts were to be housed in a local museum in Quinnahock. So we started to work towards that, basically, and they were all sent back in 2018 when the museum opened, the local museum, in a big celebration. So they are there now, all the artifacts on display in a kind of unusual museum configuration, so in an accessible way, especially for the community, which is one of the most amazing things from this project, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And the museum as well, like Carlotta says, it's, I believe, an old preschool building that got taken over. So it's relatively small, but we use the space really well. So half of the space is kind of an active lab in the summer. So when we're taking artifacts back from the field, we can do kind of immediate conservation and cleaning and things like this on them. And then the other room is the collections room. And it's been set up so that there's basically lots of cabinets with drawers that were made by the work guys locally, just in the building next door, actually, and then brought into the museum. And so basically you can open any drawer you want and kind of look through the artifacts and things. So I guess the idea is to make them as accessible as possible for the community so that you can see everything. It's not kind of packed away in boxes or anything. We're trying to get everything out as we can.
Yeah, and it was a huge investment from the community to facilitate this space and to take care of the collection. And it's a big both scientific and economic undertaking. So it really shows how important and prioritized the collection has become in people's lives and minds in Quinnahock.
First of all, also, I googled Quinnahock while you guys were talking. It looks stunning. It is very beautiful. And there's like all these raspberries in the picture that it's making me hungry. But anyway, so this museum that you were just talking about, like Lonnie and Jackie, like what role would you say it plays in the community today? Or how do people connect with it, I guess?
I think it's a very accepted project or I should say effort by the community as a whole. The way I see it, you know, everyone from little children to the oldest people in Quinnahock seem to have even a bit more pride in being Yupik since all this happened, since unfolding all this history and realizing how much more... I mean, we lived simplistically, but it's just so much more meaningful for every artifact when they have artwork on everything, even if it's like a spoon or a fork or a bowl, something as simple as that. But yeah, I think it's nothing but positive for how it affected the community and its role within the community. And the relationships also that were made, as Lonnie mentioned earlier, with the local community and the archaeologists throughout the years has been also very special. So it does play a big role. I think it's something that, you know, we're most proud of here.
Yeah. Okay. I am super interested to hear after we get back more about, because obviously we know that there's lots of archaeology projects that do not have that pride and level of connection to the community. So when we get back, I'd love to hear more about what it took to get there, essentially, or why you guys think that this is such a good partnership. But right now we're already at our first break point, so we will be right back here in a second. Okay, so I really want to dive straight into this aspect that we were just talking about right at the end of the last segment, where you were talking about how it's a really positively seen excavation and the museum, and there's a lot of community involvement and a lot of pride. So I'm just curious, you know, again, because so much of the rest of the US and across the world, there's been very much the opposite. Anthropologist can be a very dirty word. So how did you guys get to this point where things are so good?
I think a crucial thing is that the archaeologist was invited into the community by the community itself. So it's a entirely community initiated project, which means that the community had ownership of the project from the very start. It's not been proposed by outsiders, even though outsiders are working on the project. And I think that's a very important aspect. And that also means that we've been working together towards the same kind of goals and aims the whole time, even though, of course, there's the academic aims and the academic side of things, but and then there's the community aims and the community side of things. But it's been like an open communication the whole time. And even though maybe we want to reach different points along the way, we have been working together towards something united and supportive and inclusive of all different kinds of perspectives. So I think that's kind of the key.
I'll go further on what Carlotta said about the inclusiveness. And I think that's one of the best parts about this effort and our relationship with the ologists. today, as locals, we're being included, you know, in really good positions within these projects and oftentimes leadership positions where we're not used to really seeing that, maybe outside where there's such a separation culturally and maybe not a sense of respect in the same level that we feel it here. I mean, we know that these people very much respect the Yupik culture and the people and make sure that we are the decision makers in the end. And, you know, throughout history, we're not used to that so much yet. So I think this is a really great relationship to have for a project like Nunashik and everything that comes with it. And I wanted to even mention Rick Kennick a couple years ago got one of the awards, and one of you can chime in. I forgot the name of the award, but it's a pretty...
It was a good one. I can't remember. Oh, I can gosh. Google it for you.
But anyway, Rick Kennick got, you know, it's considered, you know, the maybe like one of the better advocacy jobs that an outsider does for local Native communities is, you know, maybe generally describing that. And my point is that it shows, you know, if a statewide Native organization is even picking our own Rick Kennick for such an award, even others see and look up to the relationship we have with them.
Yeah. Just to add, Jackie, the award that Rick got was the Friends of First Alaskans Ted Stevens Award.
Oh, thank you.
But I think it's also important to emphasize that it's very good from a scientific perspective as well to have this kind of community engagement and community input into your project. So I think it makes for better science, which is something I think people tend to question, but I would say they're very wrong if they think that.
I think as well, just to add something that actually Rick himself, who's not here to defend himself, so I can use his words, but something that he said that he kind of tries to remind people of on this project as well is that, you know, you kind of think, oh, are we making the best decisions going forward? Are we doing this in the right way? And he says he often thinks like in another 50 or 100 years, how would we look back on how we've organized the project and how we're doing things? And I guess we've had a lot of discussions about, well, I guess you have to try and you have to go through things to work it out as you go. And I'm sure in another 100 years, people will look back and critique some of the things that, you know, some of the decisions we made or how we went about things. But I guess, yeah, you have to try to get to where you want to be. So,
Lonnie, was there anything you wanted to add? Just to put you on the spot?
Yeah. I think to be like considered a part of the community, you need to create those relationships, and it takes time. And the archaeologists coming every summer without fail and creating these connections with people in the community and bringing gifts and spending time with them and helping them out during the subsistence times, and it's just showing signs of respect and kindness and over the many years that they've been there. And I think that's key to a lot of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mind if I add another point?
Yeah, of course. Go for it.
Thank you. So when I think Alice mentioned the science, or was it Carlotta, but how our knowledge, our local knowledge helps their science, I guess. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, is one of the most important things, is that they are recognizing our native indigenous knowledge as kind of like the forefront knowledge, and in a lot of cases, and not anecdotal. So that's another, you know, another win for us when it comes to the success of this relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and as a cultural anthropologist, I feel like that's how I was taught in this field, was that, you know, like we can have all of our interpretations, but those are all coming from our history and our, you know, cultural background, and that, you know, the communities, indigenous communities are, you know, their culture and their background, like no matter what, is going to be much closer than ours to the people that made these artifacts and belongings. And so it would be, you know, like, how is it more scientific for me to like totally make up things from my perspective than to respect cultural knowledge being passed down through the generations?
Off yeah, my soapbox. Yes.
But it sounds like obvious, but unfortunately, mm-hmm. in a lot of situations, it's not treated that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so you have this museum, like you've done these years of excavations. There's these community showcases, which I love that concept. I think that's super cool. And then you have a museum. How did we get to the point where somebody said, okay, but the next step is a digital museum?
Well, we have the museum in Quinnahook, which is amazing, but it's hard to access for people outside Quinnahook, and I wanted to basically spread the word wider and make this amazing collection and amazing knowledge available to more people.
So the idea for the digital museum, did that come more like from the community or from the archaeologists, or where did that idea like originally start?
I think the idea for the digital museum was something that I really insisted on from the beginning, but it has a prequel, and that's the educational resource that we did as a kind of main public outreach project from the AHSC-funded part of the Nunahlik project. And this was explicitly asked by board members of the Connecticut Inc. to be in digital form, so that it would be accessible and fun and talk to the younger generations in the communities and in the community. And this is how Alice came into the project.
Yeah. So I guess the educational resource, which was the first digital resource that we made, this was kind of aimed at local schools in the region. So
compared to the digital museum, it's very much aimed at kind of school age children, of kind of elementary school age, whereas a digital museum is kind of for everyone. But you can download the original educational resource on the new digital museum. There's like a tab for kids, so you can access the where it all started.
Can you tell us a little bit more about what was in the educational resource?
I mean, I guess it was a lot of similar content and a kind of similar methodology to what ended up transpiring into the digital museum. So there was reconstructions of the sod house that we've been excavating. There was some idea at that point to kind of expand out to look at the wider landscape, because we knew right from the start that obviously subsistence culture isn't, you know, just inside the sod house, it's kind of outside in the wider landscape. So it does have some elements of this, which I guess the digital museum kind of developed further into being able to kind of change the seasons and have the reconstructions from different times of year. So I think if you look at the children's educational resource, you'll see a lot of ideas that were kind of further developed into the digital museum. So I guess the educational resource is kind of like the little brother or little sister of what became the digital museum.
So how did it transfer from, you know, this educational resource into actually the digital museum?
The educational resource was aimed towards Yupik kids in especially, and to be used in schools. So it was designed for that form. And then, yeah, we wanted to, as Ali said, do something that was more for grown-ups and also introduce the collection more as a whole, because for the education pack we focus very much on things that would be accessible and explain things to kids. So with the digital museum we also have a large catalog where you can see the artifacts, and some of them are 3D and some of them in photographs, and you can use it maybe for different purposes.
Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, like Carlotta says, in the digital museum, there's kind of two sides to it. There's the exhibition, which has the kind of artwork and the interactive 3D models and the sound bites from the community and kind of photo stories and things of contemporary life. And then there's the catalog, which is just kind of a more traditional museum catalog where you can search for different artifact types and things like this. But in terms of kind of how, I guess, the methodology that we started with the children's educational resource, one of the main things was, I suppose, the way of telling stories. So we didn't want to, I guess, particularly because it was for kids and we wanted to make it fun and engaging, but also because we wanted it to have the personality of, you know, the different people in the community, the different archaeologists, and kind of bring all those, like, I don't know, I guess, kind of characters to, you know, to the interpretation of the project. The whole resource is based around kind of hearing little sound bites. So rather than kind of reading big blocks of text, you're clicking on little icons to hear from an elder or hear from somebody in the community or hear from an archaeologist. So it's this kind of multivocal way of communicating the story. And that's something that we also very much kind of took over to the digital museum, that kind of way of curating, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that is kind of striking for anyone who's worked in Nunaklik is that it is a site from the past and about the past, but the narrative is very much contemporary as well, and also looking towards the future. And this is what makes this story so engaging. So it's very important for us to keep that visible and accessible, and to make it the community story, not the story about something that was and is in the past, but something that is also contemporary and valid and relevant. So this including the contemporary aspects and perspectives and the kind of continuation of art practices and the continuation of subsistence and all these kind of things is something that we found was very important.
Yeah, I think as well, we learned a lot on the first resource that we made. I think we went in with a lot of expectations about how we would kind of I guess, do this co-curation of the collection by bringing in kind of a mixture of archaeological and community voices. And I guess a big part of what we learned on the first educational resource that we took over to the Digital Museum was, I guess, it's this thing that doing co-design and kind of co-curation doesn't mean just inviting everyone to the table to collaborate. You have to really work out, I suppose, how to get people involved in a way that works for them. So a lot of this, like Carlotta says, ended up being making things relevant for people today and bringing these contemporary connections together. So it's not simply kind of, you know, asking an elder, like, what is this artifact? I mean, so some of the sound bites are that, and people are able to talk about how they were made, how they were used. But a lot of people will use an artifact to kind of talk about a memory of going hunting, or to talk about something that they do today, or a type of tool that they use that doesn't quite look like what people used at Nunatlik. We use modern materials now, but kind of making that connection turned out to be really important. So I think one of the biggest things that we learned through making both of these digital resources was just kind of learning how to adapt, and that it was on us really to work out how to include people in a way that worked for them.
Okay, so we are already at our second break point, but we will be right back here in a second. Okay, so we're back for our last segment, which is sad because I feel like I have so many more questions. But one of the things that I loved about the article that I'd be curious to hear more about how you guys did that is you talked about really trying to convey a sense of place in the digital museum. Would somebody mind talking about how you approached that aspect?
I can talk a little bit about that, and I might pull Jackie in to talk a little bit with me, because it was really Jackie and I that were kind of collaborating on the visuals. So I guess to set it in context, when I first started working on the project, Jackie talked earlier about how a lot of the belongings and artifacts are like very beautifully carved, even if it's, you know, an everyday item like a spoon or, you know, a toggle for a kayak. It's got like little owl faces on, or it's carved to look like a seal or something like this. And somebody explained it to me, like in Yupik culture, if you want to respect the environment and the animals that you're hunting, then you make beautiful things. So this kind of essence we tried to take into designing the visuals for the project. So we knew we wanted something that really represented the place, because I think I've seen before a lot of reconstruction artworks and other kind of artworks on heritage projects where they don't really kind of capture the place. And a lot of the time, an artist won't have the opportunity to travel to that place to make the reconstructions. So they're kind of doing it from afar. And I think part of, you know, creating these visuals was, I suppose we started to see it as kind of being respectful to try and get that essence of what it's like to be in Quinnahawk, not just for local people to be able to recognize that, you know, and recognize, I suppose, look at the resource that's, you know, it's been made by outsiders ultimately, and to be able to look at that and recognize that as their home and not something, you know, kind of alien or something. Yeah. We also wanted to be able to have people who hadn't been to Quinnahawk before to get a good sense of what it's like to be there. So the way that Jackie and I worked on the reconstructions was, I think, Jackie, you kind of curated folders of your photographs for me from different seasons, so that I've been there, I could do my own sketches, but I'm usually there in the summer and maybe in the springtime. So yeah, so Jackie kind of helped curate folders of images that I could look at and kind of get the color palettes and things like this. Yeah, Jackie, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah, thank you, Alice. So pretty much from everything that Alice mentioned, I would add, I guess, that we wanted to really show that there was a human aspect within the digital museum. And so, yeah, I really like that, you know, there's a human aspect for everything you click on. Pretty much every link has almost every link, I should say, has, you know, an interview of the knowledge holder for that piece or the knowledge holder for how to make this artwork or that craft. So I've always appreciated that it was very human-based, because now when we look at, for instance, climate change films, we often, maybe our minds are conditioned to think about polar bears and melting glaciers and the animals and the environment. And I like how we all get that there's a whole human aspect to this as well in the entire process from. So I appreciate that. And yeah, the sense of how I mentioned every season is a new world here with a whole new set of resources and food and environmental challenges, ways to survive. So I thought that was a really important part of how we should show the exhibit, is to make sure we include every season and to give it that, not give it like one is more important over the other. Yeah, and if we're showing it for our audience, the Yupik people or the people of Quinhagak and the area, it's definitely relatable. We know people. This is, you know, the life we lived and still live in some cases. And then for the other audience, it still works. You know, so I like that it's understandable for a broad audience is what I was trying to say.
Yeah, and kind of tying into what you're saying there about the human aspect, I also noticed that it was pointed out explicitly that everything was labeled both in English and in, how do you say the name of the language? Yungtun?
Yupik. It's actually Yupik. Because when you say Yungtun, you're saying in Yupik. So it's like an incomplete statement. You know what I mean? You're just saying in Yupik, and you know? So
it's very meta.
Yeah.
One of my goals in being a part of the project was to incorporate our language in as many places as possible. And so so any of the labels, I would say, can we have them in both? And then for the block texts, kind of the meaningful words, and then adding those in Yupik with an English translation next to it. And those will be clickable to incorporate the yuchtun.com, the language dictionary, online dictionary. And that was sort of my focus, is to keep the language center into the project. And because there are a lot of contexts that are not spoken about in modern times, I guess. So for example, like grass basket weaving, the terminology for the weaving, the different types of grass, the like weft and like all of these technical terminologies, you don't hear them a lot. And so to be able to add them back in to say that this was done at Nunatak, and these words are still valid in context, yeah. And to be able to share that knowledge to other people.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think to me it's fairly obvious, but can you explain, like, to our audience who might not, like, have thought about it this way, like, why, like, the importance of doing this?
I'm terminology, like, we don't do a lot of grass basket weaving in our day-to-day lives, and so just having a place to speak to those and build that context again in a modern piece, I think that's important.
Well, and maybe like in a larger context too, like why it's like the, like why incorporating the language in the way that you did is so important, I guess is more what I was asking.
I guess keeping the language accessible is also important for me. and being able to click on and interact with the Yupik and hear the Yupik was important to incorporate into this digital museum. It gives a sense of this is a Yupik project. When you have the language in there and you can see the words written out and you know that this, the Nunatlak project is of a different people, and we're proud of that. And to showcase that our language is sort of alive and in new modern contexts and applicable in modern contexts.
Yeah, I mean, this seems like it took you guys a long time. You know, just like thinking about all of the different things that you guys have talked about.
I'm just like, weeping, like, softly. Yeah.
just my brain is going straight to like, wow, that this is a lot. So was this like, you know, like over what kind of a period did you guys gather these like stories and language and, you know, drawings and pictures and, you know, all of these things that you brought together into the museum? I mean, obviously there's all those years of excavations, but like taking it and pulling it all together into this format, like, it seems like a process.
I guess we got the funding for the digital museum itself in 2021, Carlotta, and then we finished the project, came out in 2023. Yeah, it was 2023. Yeah. But then a lot of the material we had gathered some of it from when we worked on the educational resource, which was between 2017 and 2020. So we had a lot of that material already, but I guess it was two field seasons in 2021 and 22 that we collected kind of new photographs and made videos and were kind of always 3D scanning the collection and things like this as we're finding new artifacts. So, yeah.
And workshops. I think workshops have been a central part of this as well. So it's been part of
the
kind of methodology and process to have arts-based workshops with Yupik artists and crafts people.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was
very central. And the dance group.
Yeah. This was a big part of particularly the digital museum, kind of a way to create an environment that can also create content for the digital museum, but puts people in a comfortable space to kind of share stories and start talking about artifacts and having a practice-based way of like doing, you know, we did workshops on drum making, dance fan making. We made a throwing spear as well. We had Earl Achak from Chivat came down. So we had kind of culture bearers coming in from different places to run, 3 or 5 day workshops here and there. And that had a lot of people. It was very, very well supported kind of from the community. A lot of people came to those workshops. And I think before or when I just joined the project, Carlotta, you'd done kind of skin sewing workshops, and there was Anna did a cuspuck making workshop.
Yeah, we had workshops as part of the celebration for the grand opening of the museum in 2018. And that was as a way of celebrating Yupik culture now and then. So local artists and local craftspeople and also some big artists and cultural bearers were invited in 2018. But that was not really part of the kind of project in the way that it was included. The content of that wasn't included in any outreach project. It was a project of its own almost, but that really kind of sparked this engagement. We find that this is a very effective way of engaging people of all different generations and make the collection alive in a way and start new conversations and kind of develop new connections between the past and the present and artifacts then and now and kind of learn a lot about the collection and ways of lives as well.
Yeah, and a lot of the workshops that we've done, I guess we've kind of taken guidance from the community on what people are interested in. So this is something we've done a lot of workshops on, kind of things related to UPIC dance. So the drum making workshop, the dance band making workshop. We did a songwriting workshop in 2018. I guess we can call that a workshop. It kind of evolved very organically with Lonnie. This is when Lonnie and I started working together to begin with. But I think this is something that's been really nice on the project, is the involvement, particularly of the young people from the dance group. And they've been kind of, they'll come and practice in the museum and things. And this has been a really nice kind of connection that the project has made. So we've very much also taken a lead from people on what they're interested in and tried to design the outreach around that. So kind of facilitating these art workshops focused on the, yeah, on the dance.
Yeah, in the past, we didn't have UPIC dance. It was discouraged by the Moravian church. And so we didn't have dance growing up, but I grew up in a different village for 3 years, and that's when I learned about, and then I went to UAF and also joined the dance group there, and so that's where the my knowledge came from. And then when we came back to the in 2018, they asked about, why don't we make a song for the celebration? And so we came up with a song about Nunatak and how these archaeologists are digging up artifacts, and it causes us to ask questions about how did they live back then. And sort of that sparked the dance group to be more involved in this Nunatak project and be integrated into the celebrations at the end of the years and all of that. So it's been a really good partnership.
I love that.
Lonnie, I was going to mention that same song you just mentioned. We mm-hmm. used it in our film in the end credits. And it's funny because our editor is out of Chicago and she knows how to sing that whole song now.
I love that. That's awesome.
Anyway, if you don't mind, I was going to add why the work is important for me, or why this effort and project is important for me. We might not see it tangibly right away, but it does teach us, through symbolism at least, language, sustainability, and data sovereignty being a big one. Like, this is our own data that we get to keep in our own communities. Land and water stewardship, a deeper sense of your identity walking in both worlds, and reversing stereotypes, and of course, cultural revitalization through the dance, through the workshops, through the entire effort. Thank you.
Yeah. You beat me to it, though. I was going to like do a rapid fire at the end and have each of you just kind of say like what has been the most like if there's like a moment that stands out to you as like the most like meaningful or like important or funniest or whatever kind of moment that stands out to you from your work altogether on this.
For me, I would have to give the credit to what I've learned from the elders during the on-camera interviews, the local indigenous knowledge that, you know, pieces that were missing. For me, I've learned a lot through interviews and the content of the interviews, and realizing how much knowledge they have to share about pieces, and that knowledge is not lost yet. So we're very fortunate to be able to have a story for the pieces.
Yeah.
I guess for me, I feel very, very privileged and very lucky to be able to work on this project and to have met all of the amazing people from Quinnahawk and kind of some, you know, many people on this call who are now consider lifetime friends, which has been fantastic. And I think working with the dance group has been so much fun and something that was quite unexpected to come out of the project. So yeah, the summers kind of working with those guys has been really fantastic.
I think for me, it's the realization, which I always had the belief that archaeology is not only about the past, it's so much more than that. But the realization that the story that we tell and the story that we become a part of is very much the contemporary and also about the future. And I think that this project has really kind of emphasized that to me, how this is what makes archaeology important. And I think it's an amazing privilege to be able to work on a project like this and to work with the people of Quinnahawk that have so much passion and knowledge and, you know, a kind of level of connection with their past and the past that we are a small part of kind of revealing as archaeologists. And I think that's kind of the big thing for me. I'm almost crying, this stupid cut that out.
No, don't. I love it.
I think as well, like working with a subsistence community, realizing how much you don't know and how much of an incompetent human being you are with all of these incredible people that have so much knowledge. Whenever I'm around at some of my friends' houses in Quinnahawk and like with Sarah and she's cutting a seal on the living room floor and doing all these amazing cuts with her ulu and things like this. And I'm like, oh, can I help with anything? And she's like, you can do the dishes. That's about the level that I have. But
I think for me, it's a lot about cultural revitalization and cultural identity and strengthening that connection to the culture. Especially, I think for me, it comes a lot from language and knowing the language. And I want to kind of sort of push that out to the other people in the community, Yupik people, and say that language was a big part of my identity, but also the cultural practices, and then just knowing your history has been really successful from this project. And to say that, oh, we know about Nunatak, and we know that the stories about Nunatak are true from these findings, and to know that this history is being preserved and passed on, and to be able to show pride in that.
Well, I have to say I'm super inspired by this project and making me feel all fired up again. Obviously, this is being recorded in April of 2025, and it's a bit of a rough moment for this kind of work here in the US. So thank you for, re-inspiring me and for all the work that you've been doing on this important effort. So, and obviously also for all the time today. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, Guyana Technok.
Guyana.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo. Thank you.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.